providing comprehensive sexual and reproductive health services to people in northern and eastern Maine since 1984. Insurance, Maine Care, self-pay accepted, and reduced fees for uninsured clients. MabelWadsworth.org.
The time is just before 10 o'clock, and you are tuned to WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill and streaming online at WERU.org. Power for the People with your host Steve Call is up next.
Good morning, and welcome to Power for the People here on WERU-FM. Power for the People's goal is to help Mainers understand and take control of their energy future, and of course, your energy budget. It occurred to me as I was prepping this show that we're now in a new energy environment after 8 years of Governor LePage, and this, in fact, is the first Power for the People in this new era. And so that's an interesting twist on a number of things. And helping us to explore those new things will be Dylan Voorhees, who I hope is on the phone with us. Dylan is the Climate and Clean Energy Director for the Natural Resource Council of Maine in Augusta. He's been on the program before, and he is broadly knowledgeable about a wide range of things. Dylan, are you there?
Yeah, good morning, Steve.
How are you doing? Thanks for being online with us. Dylan was actually involved in the creation of the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative that was been going for, I don't know, 10 or 15 years, I think. And REGI, so-called REGI, is a major funding source for the Efficiency Maine Trust and probably for the other state efficiency programs in other states in the Northeast. And that's one of the things that we can take a little bit of time to talk about here today. The big picture that Dylan and I explored in terms of topics that would be of interest to people would be the important changes in the laws for solar power. A big sigh of relief on some of those changes. There are new electric vehicle rebates and information on EV charging infrastructure in the state. There are goals for transitioning away from fossil fuels. Our renewable portfolio standards have changed. And Dylan is also involved in the Maine Climate Change Council established by the governor. In case anybody wants to hear a little bit about that. And then we will touch briefly on some changes and information on Efficiency Maine rebates. But the big picture there is that I will have somebody on from Efficiency Maine next month so we can really explore that in more detail. Anything else come to your mind, Dylan, since we've emailed in terms of things that would be important for people to hear about?
I think that's a great list.
Okay, and, I mean, it's the usual long list, and we never get to everything that we try to cover here on this program, but we'll give it a shot. Well, there is a technical snafu here. Since the storm and the power outages a week ago, our second phone line is on the fritz, and Dylan is on our first phone line. So the listener involvement would involve sending us an email at news@weru.org, and the engineer will forward that email on to me, and we'll get your question on the air. So hopefully that will work out reasonably well. At any rate, Dylan, tell us a little bit more about yourself and about NRCM, and then we'll get cracking here.
Sure. So thanks again for having me, Steve, on this indeed a stormy day here in Augusta. Anyway, it's coming down pretty hard, and we don't lose power as much here as folks in a little bit more far flung areas. But glad we could connect and have this conversation. I've been at NRCM for almost 15 years, working on climate change and clean energy policy, and lots of your listeners will know who the Natural Resources Council of Maine is, but we're about a 60-year-old citizen member-driven state-based environmental advocacy organization. Our offices are in Augusta, and we represent our members and here in the legislature and other forums to mobilize science and engage citizens to protect Maine's environment for now and future generations in lots of different areas. And indeed, this has been a long-awaited and very exciting year for a lot of environmental issues. We were just celebrating a plastic bag ban last night at an event. But certainly on climate change and on clean energy, this is a year for the history books, so I'm eager to talk about some of the details. But overall feeling is really that Maine is turning a corner, much-needed, long-awaited corner that I think is going to be good for our environment, but more to the point here, really good for our economy and for consumers who want a different kind of energy future for the state.
All right, and certainly dealing with the energy issue makes a big deal, a big difference for the environment as well.
Mm-hmm.
Let me start with a political question, always a little bit dangerous, but you'll see the context of my question here in a second, because we are in this new political climate under Governor Mills. So to me, transitioning to a renewable energy economy is in fact an economic opportunity. And I suggest actually an economic imperative, because sooner or later fossil fuels will run out. And then without alternative energy and without an alternative of some kind, it seems to me humanity will have to go back to living in caves. So it's not exactly a long-term strategy to oppose renewable energy. So to me, the idea of renewable energy shouldn't be politically partisan, but it certainly seems to be in Washington. But you're in the legislature all the time, and I try to not to pay attention to some of these things, at least a bit. It seemed reasonably bipartisan in Maine this session as we were moving forward. Is that,
yep.
Would you agree with that? And was there any significant pushback from the Republicans against moving forward with some of the things we did this year?
Well, that's a great question, Steve, and I'm happy to report that partisanship that does seem to be more on display in Washington is really not been true here in Maine yet. There's been some signs of it that are troubling, but I would say for the most part, these issues have been bipartisan. The sponsor of the big solar bill that we'll talk about in a moment, I'm sure, was sponsored by the Republican leader in the Senate, Senator Dana Dow, sponsored that bill. The lead sponsor of the governor's bill to address climate change and create a framework for addressing climate change was sponsored by another Republican senator. So there's been really significant bipartisan support for clean energy and renewable energy and on doing something about climate change. The fact is that Governor LePage was out of step with all of that, and he singularly used his veto pen and with a small number of allies really held us back, even when there was bipartisan support for moving in these directions. And without that, with certainly important leadership from the governor, but leadership on both sides of the aisle, we were able finally to get quite a lot done.
Right, and you raise an excellent point there that there was bipartisan support for a number of things, including solar, during the LePage administration. The bills passed each time, I think, that they came up,
right.
And they were vetoed by Governor LePage, which is what got us to where we were in that period of time. So I'm a native Mainer, and I'm proud of the fact that we're as bipartisan as we are, and I hope we can stay that way, because it just you do things for the good of society, not for the good of the party, in my perspective. So sorry for that opinion, but there it is. So I mentioned REGI up top, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, which most people are probably familiar with, at least the name. But just because I mentioned it and because you were involved, and actually I didn't know that you were involved in getting it established, tell us, give us a little bit, you know, the nickel background on what REGI is all about, how it works and its advantages, and then we can get to how it funds Efficiency Maine.
Sure. So as you're right. We joined and established REGI a little bit more than 10 years ago. It's been operating for about 10 years, and it addresses carbon pollution that comes from power plants. Transportation, cars and trucks are now the largest source of carbon pollution in Maine and actually nationally. But we've had, going back, a huge problem, and we still have a smaller problem, still a challenge, with the amount of pollution from power plants. And REGI was a solution to that, or a big part of the solution to that, and has a couple of characteristics. First of all, it's states working together. So there are states from Maryland and Delaware up to Maine working together in a collective approach, and that's really a good way to do it. And it's really a market-based initiative. It's It takes advantage of competition in markets to get the best results for consumers while achieving reductions in carbon pollution. The fact is that power plants historically in this country, in many parts of the country, have polluted unlimited amounts of carbon pollution without paying any price for that. And that's sort of unfair and unsustainable. And so what this policy does is it says, well, we're gonna limit the amount of carbon pollution that power plants can put out. We're going to rely on the market to figure out the best way to reduce it, but enough's enough. You can't just put unlimited pollution into the atmosphere for free. It's like dumping your garbage on your neighbor's lawn. You can't do that. So this initiative requires puts a cap or a limit on the total amount of carbon pollution, and you can't emit for free anymore. You have to pay to buy an allowance or a credit. And the state receives that money and reinvests that money, as you've said, into efficiency programs, weatherization and other efficiency programs, which in turn help lower our energy costs. And lower the amount of energy that we need to use. And so it's a virtuous cycle. So it's been incredibly successful. Economists have looked at it. They found that it's created jobs on net. It has lowered energy costs in total. And emissions from the power plant sector are way down over the course of this 10 years or so. So a big success and something we continue to want to build on in different ways.
Great, I appreciate that. And I think last I knew there were 10 states in it. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
10 northeastern states.
Yeah, and so New Jersey was out for a while under Chris Christie, and they're back now. And Virginia is actively exploring joining with Reggie.
Okay, is that 10 states or 11? I think it was originally 11 states, wasn't it?
Yeah, and then I don't know. That's a good question. And then New Jersey left. It might have been 10 to 9, but it's an enormous area. If the Reggie region was its own country, then we would be, you know, something like the eighth largest polluter in the world, right? So the northeast of the United States is a giant population base. It's an economic powerhouse in itself, and we're responsible for emissions that are globally significant. So it's a big deal,
right? And as you said, it's a market-based system, and so there's a cap set. And if you don't use all of your credits, I'm going to stumble through saying this and correct my language if you need to. If you don't use all of your credits, you can actually sell those, as I understand. And if you need more than your credits, you can buy those. That's in essence how it works, correct?
That's mostly right, except nobody gets any. You've got to buy them all.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Nobody gets to pollute for free. If you want to pollute, you got to pay. And you can, of course, buy and sell them amongst, you know, other power plants and with others. So that's where the market goes in. There's a market for those. But nobody gets them. Nobody gets to pollute for free. You have to pay a price. It's a pretty small amount, actually. But it's helping send a signal to power plants. You know, you gotta move in this direction toward cleaner power.
And, you know, the news is always bad in the media about carbon pollution, but I don't have the numbers right here in front of me, but in round numbers, I think the Clean Power Plan formed under President Obama has reduced emissions from power plants specifically about 30% since 2005. That, of course, the Clean Power Plan was rolled back by President Trump, and so emissions have crept back up again, but it's possible to have successes on these fronts. And that's one of the messages that I always try to convey to the students in my classes is that let's not give up. There are ways to get these things done. And, of course, relative to this program, part of it is renewable energy.
Absolutely. And with power plants, we have made significant progress in this region and in New England and the Northeast. You mentioned the renewable portfolio standard, not wanting to get ahead of things, but we're now on track to get 80% of our power from renewables within 10 years, if not sooner, and on our way beyond that. And so we're really making tremendous progress, and I'm very optimistic. We're going to use solar, we're going to use wind, we're going to use renewables to really decarbonize where we get our power from. And that's a very positive story. We've made a lot of progress, and we're on track and optimistic about getting the rest of the way.
Right. And I do want to say, because I just saw a piece in my online feed just yesterday talking about the fact that carbon is not necessarily just CO2. Certainly methane is a big deal for climate change, if that's something that you're concerned about. Because methane actually has 82 times the heat absorbing capacity of CO2, and there's a lot of methane out there, and we're fracking, and there's leakage coming out of pipes and out of wells, and so it's more than just CO2.
Yep.
And that's one of the messages that I do try to drive home to my students when I speak to public groups as well.
Yeah, and the thing about methane, there are multiple sources, including agricultural sources, but a lot of those sources, as you've said, actually also have to do with our fossil fuel dependence, particularly natural gas. So the wells, the pipelines, they're leaking methane. And so the transition away from fossil fuels, not just coal and oil, but actually natural gas, is going to be a part of reducing methane pollution too.
Right. And natural gas is cheaper, and so it is replacing coal. That's a really good thing. I mean, the amazing number to me is that coal a decade ago was 52% of the national grid generation for electricity, and it's now down to like 24%. Tremendous decline in coal. That's largely due to methane, natural gas. It's partly due to renewables.
Yep.
But the interesting thing is that of the various fossil fuels, the only one that still is seeing an increase in greenhouse gas emissions is natural gas.
That's right. And so, that's true here in our region. We get a close to half of our power from natural gas. So it's still a big factor. We've squeezed out coal and oil as a general matter for how we generate power in our region. We still have this big natural gas dependency, and now wind and solar are able to eat into that dependency on natural gas, and that's exciting. And those prices have just continued to come down. Wind and solar are now, they're just better economic investments.
Right.
And we have all of these power plants sitting around, and we're using them and we need them, but we can actually be more bullish about replacing that dependency because wind and solar technology has continued to change, and the economics are just really excellent, actually.
That's right. In most cases, solar and wind are actually less expensive than new natural gas generation. I really hope that somehow we can get leadership in the state and in Washington that can send the message that natural gas is a bridge fuel to the renewable energy future. And I don't think that that's part of the national lexicon yet, but it needs to be.
Well, the challenge with the idea of a bridge fuel is it implies we need to sort of keep investing in natural gas for a while longer. And the fact is that's not the case. We need to be getting onto the off-ramp now of that bridge. So we of course can't just stop all consumption of natural gas tomorrow, but we cannot actually afford to make further investments in natural gas choices and infrastructure, or that bridge will go too far and that off-ramp will be costly. Steve, you mentioned a minute ago, eventually running out of fossil fuels. The fortunate or I would say unfortunate reality is there's still a tremendous amount of fossil fuels in the ground, and we can't actually afford to run out of them. If we have run out of fossil fuels, we have committed the planet to mass extinction levels of warming. And that's the clock that's actually now ticking, according to scientists. We need to leave some of it in the ground, and we can do that now with the technology that's available, whether you're a household or business or a society.
That's exactly right. And one of the points that I make when I speak to the public and in my classes is, bottom line is, we're not going to burn the last drop of oil anyway because it's going to be outrageously expensive. And the other part of it is, fossil fuels do have their uses in other ways rather than just burning them.
Mm-hmm.
And having them not be there anymore. So I agree completely on that. No question about it. We have both mentioned the renewable portfolio standard, and I always want to make sure that we don't get ahead of the audience too much. But let me just remind everybody that this is Power for the People. The guest is Dylan Voorhees, the Energy and Climate and Clean Energy Director for the Natural Resource Council of Maine, broadly knowledgeable on all sorts of things we're talking about here. And unfortunately, today we aren't taking any phone calls on this program, but you can email us, and I will get that message and get it on the air. So the email address is news@weru.org. So before we go to the renewable portfolio standard, though, let's loop back, because I did mention at the top how Reggie funds the Efficiency Maine Trust, which then provides incentives and rebates out to the public. Tell us what the link is there, how that funding mechanism works.
Yeah, so Maine currently is receiving, and this amount goes up and down because it is based on a market for Reggie, but in the order of $10 million a year is going from these sale of these carbon credits, and all of that money in Maine currently goes to Efficiency Maine for their different programs that Efficiency Maine runs, and I'm glad to hear you're going to have a deeper dive into what Efficiency Maine has to offer. Efficiency Maine is a quasi-independent entity in the state, created by the state for the purpose of helping Maine consumers, including all the largest consumers, businesses and industry and towns, as well as individuals, use less energy by investing in energy efficiency and conservation measures. And they're a fantastic resource, a great website. There's a number you can call, and they have lots of ways that they can help, that they help people invest in energy efficiency every day, whether you go into a grocery store and you buy an LED light, you may not know that Efficiency Maine has helped reduce the price of that for you to buy. They also support programs that give rebates for folks when they get work done in their home to add insulation or seal up leaky spaces. There's rebates from Efficiency Maine, and actually those kinds of household measures that insulation and more efficient sort of heating systems and buildings, that has been supported mostly by funds from Reggie for many years. So if you've insulated your house, you've gotten $500 or $1,000 off from Efficiency Maine, that money was coming from Reggie. It also has helped a lot of paper mills and hospitals invest in much larger equipment that can help them reduce oil and other energy expenditures. So it's been a really great success and important source of revenue to help Maine consumers reduce their energy bills.
Yeah, no question about that. It's a great resource. In my own case, I don't have the number off the top of my head, but I've received something like $2,000 from them for insulation. I don't know how to amortize the, put a number on the LED light bulbs, but that's part of it. I've got two heat pumps and have reduced my heating oil in my house to zero, I'm pleased to say. Mm-hmm. And I have a hybrid hot water heater. So all of those things came with assistance from Efficiency Maine, which ultimately is related to that market program called the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative.
Excellent.
So back to the renewable portfolio standard. So we all say RPS, but it's renewable portfolio standard. What it's about, and it's talking about any given state, or I suppose a city could have it. I don't know about that. For their targets for greenhouse gas emissions or renewable energy, as the case may be. Tell us where we've been with that, and where we're going, and perhaps use that as the opportunity to lead into your experience so far with the Governor's Climate Change Council.
So most states, I think it's probably around 35 or so, have a renewable portfolio standard or something very much like it. And that is a law that says we're gonna transition to renewable power, and here's the numbers to put to it. So there are requirements that utilities or those, in our case in Maine, it's not actually utilities selling the power, generating the power, but if you sell power in the state of Maine, you need to meet minimum amounts of renewable energy. as part of that portfolio. Today, it's a 40% requirement. So 40% of the electricity sold to consumers in Maine today, by law, has to come from renewables. That's been about where we've been for quite a long time. Actually, there's been about 40% or 30 to 40% from renewables for decades. So it's good, but we haven't been making a lot of progress to change that percentage. And this year, bill sponsored by Senator Vitale, who's a leader in the Senate, changed that number to 80% by the year 2030. And each year it will go up between 40% and 80%. Each year that requirement will go up. And that tells power plant operators and developers, build some more renewables and plan on using less of those natural gas power plants, because this is the law. We're headed toward 80% of our power coming from renewable resources within 10 years. And the governor's been very committed to that. And she's also even said, yeah, we're not stopping there. We don't have all the legal framework in place, but we're going to be headed to 100% from there. So that's a very effective policy that nudges the market. It's a requirement. It's not just a, hey, we'd love to do this. It's a requirement, but it's incremental each year to move the needle. And 80% of our power coming from renewables is a very positive thing, and we're really within striking distance.
And just to clarify, so existing hydropower does not count towards the renewable portfolio standard?
Well, it does. In the numbers I'm talking about, the total numbers, it does. The policy is quite complicated, and it does have different definitions and tiers of renewables. And hydropower, you know, some hydropower counts for some and not for others. But in terms of the total numbers, that 80% hydropower, any hydropower in the state of Maine is going to qualify for that and help us get to that total. Mm-hmm. But we're not going to build new hydro in Maine. That's just not a practicality. So we have what we have. If we want to increase that percentage, it's going to come from building new renewables, and that means solar more than ever. We realize that's going to be playing a big role, wind power, and including offshore wind.
But if we did new hydro at an existing dam, that would be allowed to count, correct?
Yes, but that's just not very economic. So this is a market. We have a market for power, and people have different views about hydro, and it really depends on the individual facility whether it's a good deal for the environment. In many cases, it is, but economically, building any new hydro infrastructure is just not as cheap as building new wind and solar. So it's not likely that that's going to be a big part of what is newly built in the state of Maine or
right,
anywhere around
right.
us.
Yeah, it certainly makes sense. Let's see. So we were going to talk about electric vehicle rebates and solar mm-hmm. power. So let's go towards those. But again, just to remind everybody that unfortunately our second phone line is out here. So if you do have any questions, especially as we start talking about solar here, because there are big changes with net metering and things like that the listeners may want to know more about. If you have a question for Dylan for us to talk about here on air, send an email to news@weru.org, and I will get that message on the air for you. So let's start with the rebates, because that is indeed brand new since the last time we were on the air.
Mm-hmm.
And so the state has rolled out electric vehicle rebates to combine with the federal tax credits,
mm-hmm.
and this is funded by the settlement with Volkswagen, because they were having their emissions cheating issue that they got caught doing. And so they have funded the state of Maine. And I believe that funding is all going into rebates and EV infrastructure. But to give us a little bit of feedback on the background there, and then we can talk about the rebates specifically.
Yeah, good. Well, that was a great summary, Steve. That's right. Right now, what the governor and others have decided is that that money, and it's the portion that's available for that kind of electric vehicle infrastructure and rebates is nearly $8 million or around that from multiple settlements with Volkswagen, and it has all been directed to Efficiency Maine, which has been, you know, helping people get rebates for insulation and equipment for a long time, and so it was a natural place to say, well, we want to spur electric vehicle uptake. So Efficiency Maine is pursuing both grants and investments in for electric vehicle charging. We can talk a little bit about that. There's lots to do there, but some good things happening. And now, just the latest, instant rebates on a purchase of a new electric vehicle. So we walk into a dealership that's participating, and they will instantly mark down the prices. So that's very exciting and very important to, you know, I think I mentioned, the biggest source of global warming pollution is the transportation sector. 54% of our carbon emissions are coming from transportation, and most of that from cars and trucks. We need to do a lot of things, from more buses to land use planning to car sharing and vanpooling. But electric vehicles are now available as a really important part of the strategy to decarbonize and reduce our fossil fuel dependence. So helping consumers get into those cars and get charging infrastructure to make that transition convenient and appealing, very important to the state. The governor's been very committed to that, and we're excited to see that those programs rolling out now.
Right. And so so on the federal side, depending on the model that you can get up to $7,500 as a tax credit.
Yeah.
And then on the state side, you can get, I think individuals can get $1,000 per vehicle, and some nonprofit or municipalities can get $2,000. Is that the way that works?
So individuals can actually get $2,000 off of an all-electric vehicle, so a Chevy Bolt. There's actually models coming out every time you turn around, there's a new model coming out, and the prices are coming down, and we should talk about that a little bit. But you can get $2,000 off of that. If you are a low-income household, I believe that the number is $3,000. And if you are a municipality or kind of unit of government, those folks can't really take advantage of the federal tax credit, and so you can get – the state will give you $7,500. So if you're the town of Blue Hill, you can get from Efficiency Maine $7,500 off of an electric vehicle. But for most folks, it's $2,000 for an all-electric car, and they're going 250 miles now. And with the federal tax credit, you know, that's up to $9,500 off the price, really attractive opportunity.
Right, and that certainly brings them down to be very competitive with even lesser expensive gas models, no question about it.
Yeah, and you can find information on Efficiency Maine's website about the, you know, which cars qualify and all the details, where the participating dealers are. You can find information about how much you can save because these are cheaper to fuel, much cheaper to maintain. And they're fun to drive, and so I encourage people to try them out. These are great set of vehicles that we've surveyed electric vehicle owners in the state. There's 2,000 of them or thereabouts, and growing every day. They love them. People will highly recommend these vehicles to their friends and family. So I encourage people to get in them and drive them and try them out and think about them. And those federal tax credits may get extended. We're sort of hoping that's true, but currently they are on a phase-out trajectory. So certainly a great time to think about an electric vehicle.
And I owned a plug-in Prius for a long time that now belongs to my daughter. And I have to say, I'm going to chat here just for in a second about the low-cost thing that you mentioned, but it's just joyful to drive a vehicle in 100% electric mode. It just it's quiet, it's responsive, it makes you feel good.
Yep.
And the relative price of electricity is about $1.35 a gallon. for gasoline. So there's your first savings. But you mentioned low cost. Interesting, when I talk about electric vehicles in my classes at Thomas College, the students go, no, we're not going to buy an electric vehicle. And by the end of the class, when I've talked about the fact that you don't have to do a brake job because they have regenerative braking, you don't have to do any of the things, spark plugs, emissions, exhaust system, you don't have to do any of that stuff, they go, really? You know, maybe we will consider that. I mean, it's just kind of the light in the light goes off. So the rebates are for new vehicles, just to be clear on that. But
that's
interestingly,
right.
you can find things like Nissan Leafs coming off of leases. That's always difficult to say.
Yeah,
you can find a Nissan Leaf that's 2 or 3 years old for $9,000 or $10,000.
That's right. The used vehicle market is not big, but it's quite attractive. I myself have eyeballed, you know, some opportunities. And the Chevy Bolt, which is an all-electric vehicle, newer, is I think, going to soon start entering the used vehicle market as some of the first of those come off their three-year leases. And, of course, the big way to grow the used vehicle market is juice the new vehicle market. Because, of course, like myself, I've never bought a new car. These vehicles are cycling into the used vehicle market, and the more we accelerate purchase of new vehicles, many of which are getting leased for 3 years, the more we create opportunities for folks to get a used electric vehicle as well.
Okay, and one thing that I've always wondered about, the opportunity for the federal government to get involved in this, the post office, for example, their little cubes that run around town are 20 or 30 years old. They're the perfect opportunity for to have plug-in vehicles because they have short range, you know, just a small number of miles per day, and they can plug them in every night. And so we need again to change our mindset in terms of how we go about these things and how we think about them as a society.
Yeah, and FedEx has started to invest in electric delivery trucks. Just about a month ago, Amazon made headlines by putting an order in for an enormous number, 100,000 all-electric delivery trucks, which is, you know, in one sweep, this is Amazon for you. Their order would if it was, you know, those trucks were delivered tomorrow, double the number of electric delivery trucks in the world. So there's huge opportunities for, you know, medium-duty vehicles as well. And just a little bit on the charging station, Steve, if you want to talk about that, we're putting the state's putting charging stations in. Private parties are putting charging stations in. Municipalities are putting them in. Different kinds, so-called level two chargers, where you really do need to be parked for a while. But if you're staying overnight or at the park for a day or parked while you go around town, you can get quite a bit of charge. And there are then also these super fast chargers that the state is putting on the interstate and other travel corridors that charge very quickly. And those are all really important to be out there so people see them. Those folks, of course, who are most of your audience who are not driving an electric vehicle right now may be interested to understand the overwhelming majority of charging is happening at home. You get home, you plug in your car, pretty straightforward. You leave every morning with a full, quote, tank of juice. And that is cheap. It's convenient. You never stop at a gas station, but you almost never are going to stop at a charging station either. But having those charging stations around, whether it's for longer distance travel or just for convenience or to give people some comfort, really important. So I'm glad to see the state investing, beginning to invest more and more in those publicly available charging stations.
Right, and two other little wrinkles on that. There are a number of employers who offer free charging for people with vehicles like that. So I mentioned $1.35 a gallon. Can you say zero per gallon? And the other part of it is, you know, I wish I had an audience in front of me to say, guess how many charging stations there are in the state of Maine? We did an electric vehicle charge-in thing at Thomas College last spring, and so I was looking into this. There's 480 charging stations in the state of Maine, way more than you'd think. We do have an email here, so let me get back and open up my phone again. And so it says, are electric vehicles, I guess it's three questions here. Are electric vehicles good in the snow? Do you need to have a garage? And how do you set up the plug-in thing?
Good. Good questions. And I think, you know, we're needing to do as a state, and NRCM will do more, Efficiency Maine will do more of sort of creating educational opportunities for people to learn these kinds of things. We're really at the beginning stages of that. Certainly, there's a range of vehicles available, and so you know, clearance and other things are, you know, take a look at individual cars. So we did a ride and drive. I don't know, Steve, if you had a Hyundai Kona at your drive. I don't know if it was available. It's very new.
Yeah, I don't think we did. No.
Yeah. So it's people call it a crossover. It's got a little higher clearance, and it's a little bit bigger than the Bolt. It's not an SUV by any stretch. And so whatever a crossover means to you, it's a little bit like that. That's certainly an option for people for looking for, you know, a little more clearance. So these cars are perfectly drivable all through the winter, and they're being driven all across the cold weather climates. You know, Norway is on their way to getting rid of all gasoline-powered cars. So it gives you a little bit of a sense of whether these are make sense in northern winter climates. They absolutely do. They don't. The batteries don't work as well in the winter. So you have a car that goes 250 miles in the on a full battery in the summer. It won't go as far in the winter. That's just the reality. Those batteries are getting better and bigger and cheaper. But there is some change to, that's weather dependent. In terms of a garage, you absolutely don't need a garage at all to have an electric vehicle, and lots of people driving electric vehicles don't have a garage. You don't even need any fancy equipment necessarily. Steve mentioned you had a plug-in Prius, and there are plug-in hybrids that are both gasoline and electric. Those have lots of advantages, some disadvantages to all electric. You'll still need occasional oil changes, but those vehicles have smaller batteries, and you can plug them into a dryer, you know, a 220 outlet outside your house without much effort. If you are going to get an all-electric car, you probably want to consider getting an outside charging station, but it's not that expensive. And it's really quite convenient once you get used to it. It is a little bit harder for folks that rent. So if you rent a place, you don't have that option, whether you're in a single-family home or a multifamily home, and that's why the state should probably put some more effort into making charging options available for renters and multifamily. But if you own a home, get some more detailed information, look at the options, I think, folks will find it is feasible.
Right, and bottom line is, if it's parked all night, essentially you can fill the battery overnight, even at 120 volts. It's really not that's not quick, but it certainly can happen on an overnight. And you mentioned Norway. The last numbers I saw was for 2017, and it was essentially 50% of the cars in Norway were plug-in vehicles last year, and a similar number of the new cars have been sold in California. It's coming. And my personal take on it is, for two-car families, if you have two cars, one of them ought to be electric.
It's
that simple.
Yep.
We also have another question related. I have two more emails here. Again, send us an email at news@weru.org if you like. One of the questions was, what about power outages, which I thought was a little bit amusing since we just had one.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the issue is, during a power outage, you often can't get gasoline either.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us what's your take on power outages.
Yeah, well, I don't. There's no magic answer there. We need utilities that provide reliable power for all kinds of reasons, and that's going to be increasingly important in the future. The broad trend of a clean energy economy is going to be to use electricity more. It's a very convenient fuel, and we can produce it with renewables. Including large grid-scale renewables and right on your own home or business with solar. So the future is an electricity future. It's going to rely on a reliable, smart grid that has consumers you know, empowered to produce their own power and make choices about how they consume power. There's two sides of having a big battery-powered vehicle in your garage. One is, yeah, at the end of the day, you do need the power to be on. If it's not on for a little while, that may not be the end of the world. You may get to make a trip to a public charging station that you otherwise wouldn't. But the other side of it is, you actually have an enormous source of power in your garage. And we're not too far away from the point where that's like a source of power when the power is out. Having battery storage in your home is, it's a difference. It's something we're going to take some adjustment to. But it actually creates a lot of opportunities for consumers to do different things.
Right. And so Europe and Japan are already doing the battery in the car is running your home option. And I hope we get there soon. I don't understand why we aren't there yet.
It's complicated, and there's more to do. But you know, again, if your power's out for a day or two, would you rather drive fewer miles and not lose all the food that's in your refrigerator, right? Or you know, that's the opportunity. You've got a Chevy Bolt parked outside. That's enough juice to keep your refrigerator running for a while.
Right.
And we're not there yet, but I think that's the kind of opportunity that a electrified renewable consumer empowering system could be.
Right. Let's pivot to solar. And just to remind everybody, our phone line is out. So if you want to drop us an email quickly here in the last 15 minutes, it's news@weru.org. And I'm speaking with Dylan Voorhees from the Natural Resource Council of Maine, their climate and clean energy director. And so I have an email here from somebody who says, I understand there is pollution associated with the creation of solar panels. And of course, the answer to that is yes. Everything that humans do has pollution associated with it, an impact. And he says, could you address that and tell us what the greenest, most environmentally benign energy for a homeowner to consider using might be?
Not using as much energy is the most benign and cost-effective energy solution for a homeowner or a business. So conservation and energy efficiency, number one, number two, and number three. Seal up the leaks. Don't heat the outdoors is the first step. Install energy-efficient appliances, lighting, heating systems. Get the right amount of insulation in your walls. That is the most important. And what we're finding, and it's more work in an existing building than in a new building, is you can now require very, very little energy to heat and power homes. And in a new home, those numbers have gone, way down. That's the first thing. Reduce how much of any kind of energy you need for your home or business, and then second from that, it's solar. Solar panels are pretty benign. There is some copper wires in them, but our society is chock full of copper wires. It's silicon, right? It's a benign material. We can and should be recycling solar panels. Of course, as you say, Steve, there's environmental cost to producing and manufacturing anything. But solar panels that are going to last you for 30 years or more, no moving pieces, very reliable and cost effective, and you can put them right on your home or business and power your home or business without any fossil fuels. That's a really winning solution for transitioning away from fossil fuels.
And this has come up on this program before, and people have asked about how do we recycle solar panels. And the bottom line is, if you look at a solar panel built in the 70s, it's still producing 50 or 60% of its rated power.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no reason to recycle it at this point. So it's there's no question that solar is in fact the most benign. I mean, you can talk about wind mm-hmm. that has moving parts and has all sorts of production issues as well. And wind just typically doesn't work for their average homeowner.
Wind has other advantages, right? So solar works a lot of the time. It does not work when the sun is not shining, and that's not that's just a feature. You know, that's not there's not any way around that. Wind power, we get pretty good wind at night. We get good wind in the winter. So a clean energy grid and future is, I'm convinced, absolutely going to depend on a combination of wind, solar, other resources, and bits of batteries. But certainly from a homeowner or a business perspective who wants to own and invest in and benefit from their own generation of power, it's solar all the way.
Right. And of course, hydro can help out at night as well, mm-hmm. since we were talking about that earlier.
Yep.
So continuing along the line, actually, this is a little bit of a combination of grid and EVs and perhaps solar. We have an email here from Jesse May. It says, please talk about the grid stability for charging electric vehicles. It says, we are a grid-tied solar home. Thank you for that. And try to do hardcore electric uses during the daylight hours. How, in theory, could increasing consumption as a society for, I presume it means electric vehicles, I'm not sure.
What does that mean? Yeah.
Right.
Well, that's a really good question. And states that are a bit ahead of us on solar power and electric vehicles and sort of renewable penetration, like California, are giving us some hint of what the future can be. We right now are very much have an interest in Maine in charging electric vehicles off peak in the evenings, actually, ideally in the middle of the night. And you plug in your car, and it will know. And we can. It's not that hard to program cars and chargers to charge in the middle of the night when there's excess power. It's cheap. We're not running the most dirty and expensive power plants. So charging electric vehicles off in the evening is great and what we need to do to reduce stress on the grid as a general matter. But as we move towards more and more solar, that equation starts to shift. And so in parts of California, they want people charging in the middle of the afternoon. There is so much solar getting produced, more than people are demanding. They're saying, you know what, charge now. So we need a system that's dynamic. It's going to evolve over time. As an individual household, you might find that there's different times of the day that make sense to charge. And we have a lot to do with getting our utilities in the right gear to work with consumers and have the best outcomes. But ultimately, electric vehicles can be very good for the electricity grid because they can smooth out when we need power, and actually can reduce rates overall by better utilizing the system when it's underutilized.
Right. And I think you are aware of the study that I did for when I had worked for a previous employer, where we looked at a subset of the state of Maine and used LIDAR to determine which rooftops could actually support solar, would mm-hmm. be good solar choices. And our conclusions in 2012 were at the time that 56% of if we put solar on every rooftop that was suitable for solar in the state, it would generate 56% of the state's electricity. That was in mm-hmm. 2012 when mm-hmm. panels were 250 watts.
Yeah.
Today they're 350 watts.
And
bump
cheaper.
Bump that number up, right. Bump that number up to close to 80%.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of grid reliability, in terms of that last question, if every home in the state was reducing its draw on the grid, let's just say by 50%, we don't need to do all the investment that is currently planned in the grid.
Yep.
And that comes back to the Booth Bay project that we don't have time to talk about, but we have talked about on this program.
That's right. And we pay the driving costs of our electricity system are from the peak times when we need power. When we need the most, that is what we pay for. That is the majority of our costs, whether it's the grid itself, the delivery system, which has to be scaled for that peak time, or it's the power plants themselves. We turn power plants on, as a general matter, from cheapest to most expensive. So the more you need, the more expensive the plants you're operating. So that time of each day, that time of each month, each year that we use the most, that is the most expensive. That is what drives electricity costs for consumers. It's what drives our rates up. And when you can use solar to reduce that amount, it is a big benefit. And ISO New England, the regional grid, led by Vermont and Massachusetts and other states, and hopefully we'll catch up, has built enormous amounts of solar. Massachusetts has a boatload, which is a technical term, Steve, of solar. And it's saving all of us a lot of money. It already is saving us a lot of money, because those days when we need the most, we're needing to operate fewer of the most expensive and most polluting, actually, power plants.
Right. We have a comment here from somebody from John from Rhinebeck, New York, underscoring that you can get WERU anywhere at WERU.org, anywhere in the solar system. And his comment is related to, I think, what we're talking about here: photovoltaics on every roof, lithium batteries in the basement, and a solar-powered electric vehicle.
Yep.
Affordable, safe, quiet, and reliable. And,
absolutely.
And I certainly applaud that. And let's use that to transition as quickly as we can in the 5 minutes left to talk about bills that, for example, restored net metering.
Yep. So a bunch of things happened this session on solar that are making it a really good time to invest in solar, and going to make the next couple of years a really exciting time for solar. The legislature restored net metering this session. That means they repealed this draconian fee on people generating their own power that was known as gross metering that the LePage Public Utilities Commission had put in place a year or two ago. So now we have net metering like we used to, but clean and clear to stay for a while. That's great, and of course, federal tax credits for solar are still there. They're also scheduled to go down, so makes it a really good time to invest. But two or three other things quickly, Steve, that happened this session. One, the legislature passed laws that will make it a lot easier for municipalities and sort of larger businesses to invest in more larger scale and sort of medium scale solar, megawatt scale on a landfill, on a rooftop. That policy's complex, but at the end of the day, what it ultimately is about is helping us get our towns and our businesses better able to take advantage of solar. And along with that, the other thing that happened is a tremendous policy on community solar, larger scale community solar, not five people working together, which is fine, but really pretty costly, actually, way to do community solar. Large scale community solar, where you can fill a landfill size or of a couple of megawatts of solar and have hundreds of consumers able to get solar on their electric bill, and the municipality and a couple of businesses. So we're going to see a tremendous push to build community solar farms, much larger ones in the state. And that's great news for low and moderate income households, people that rent, towns and cities that want to see their electric bills go down. So it was a gangbuster year for solar policy in the state, and we're very excited about.
I certainly do agree with that. In the 1 minute left, I have one more email that came in, and it says, how does road maintenance and building new roads happen without the gas tax when there are more electric cars? And I'll just throw out one is that we could put a surcharge on tires, since that will continue to be an issue. But in 30 seconds, any other thought you have on that?
Well, we're going to need the gasoline tax for quite a while to come. And sadly, we're not buying any less gas than we were 10 years ago. We're driving more miles. We're not making a fast enough transition. We need that gas tax to pay for roads and bridges. Ultimately, we'll need to come up with new solutions.
Yep.
We've got time to do that. Right now, we need to push down on encouraging people to get in electric cars.
Great. Thanks so much, Dylan Voorhees from the Natural Resource Council of Maine. And great stuff. Look forward to having you on again at some point in the future. This has been Power for the People here on WERU. Next month, I'll have on a staff member from Efficiency Maine to talk specifics on their services. See you next month.